The Rosie on the House Arizona Hour, driven by Sanderson Ford.
D's are boring.
Well, we lost an Arizona icon this week. The Bedrock Flintstones theme park shut down after being opened in 1972. They're going to have to reprint the Arizona's Weird Things book now. But we were talking about the hash knife. You can send. You know, we got a business trip coming Wednesday. You can send mail.
Oh, great.
Via Pony Express.
Love it.
Wednesday from the Creekside Steakhouse and Tavern in Christopher Creek. So the restaurant opens at noon. We're going to get up there, have lunch. Pony Express is expected to come by between 1:30 and 2:30. So we're going to go have a cheeseburger and watch our mail get picked up. We got to think of something funny to send Rosie and have it delivered on Pony Express down
to
the Prada del Sol.
Think they come to the house? Think the Pony Express to stop by the house? Wouldn't that be fun?
Take a small detour.
Something LSU-ish.
Yes.
That's like completely out of the Western theme
of
the Pony
Express. We got it right here. You've got the jackalope, the rabbit, and the deer combined. We got to do like an LSU tiger and an elk horn or something. Alligator head and an elk horn. Dad
there
did
you
that.
Go. Okay. We're working on it.
So that's Wednesday, and you can go to Hash Knife Pony Express website and see all the different places that they're pickups and drop-off and have something delivered in mail via Pony Express. But this hour we're talking with author Heidi Osler of Arizona's Deadliest Gunfight. Great. I have not gotten through the majority of the book, but one thing I have thoroughly enjoyed about it is you've got a great vocabulary. You don't need a dictionary of thesaurus, but you do challenge the reader to expand their vocabulary stuff, and it's very enjoyable.
Thank you.
So we've got the shootout that happened. Mm-hmm. And one of the things before we get to the manhunt was just the transition of time that we were talking about in, you know, you're going from Old West to, you know, an industrial new world. And there was a lot of, you know, we had machine guns, but we still had six shooters. And it was a very, a manhunt today, you've got cell phones, helicopters, right. GPS, radio antenna. I mean,
drones.
They had drones. They had telegrams, smoke signals, horses.
They did. And they had bloodhounds going after the boys, and which is very old and traditional way of hunting people. They also had some scouts from the San Carlos Indian Reservation tracking them as well. But most of the posse were on trucks, and that wasn't a real good way to track them because they were in the Dragoon Mountains and the Chiricahuas and rough areas of New Mexico. They were on horseback at first until their animals played out, and Tom Power and Sisson were all for a few days, and then they were on foot after that, hiding out. There were over 1,000 people looking for them, many of whom were members of the cavalry because they were guarding the border in wartime. But there were rumors, I never was able to substantiate this, that they tracked down an airplane and had searchlights on it at, you know, it would have been those old biplanes flying around in World War I, like the Red Baron, looking for them. And so they evaded the law for 28 days until finally they surrendered to cavalry when they were over the border in Mexico.
And this was just sheer exhaustion.
It was.
One of them had been injured. The bullet went through his nose and struck his left eye. And
well, actually, he didn't get a bullet in the eye. This is John Power. It did strike the bridge of his nose, I think. It was mostly debris from the gunfight. They were at the windows. It was glass and wood and metal objects that were flying. Both John and Tom Power sustained injuries in their left eyes, their non-shooting eye. And by the time the cavalry caught up to them, they gave up because they were barefoot, they were dehydrated, they were starving. And the cavalry officer said there were maggots in John's eye. Oh. It was so infected.
That's, well, at what point that's what they say, hard bark. Those boys had some hard bark on them.
At what point did they realize what they were being, you know, sought after for? You said when they showed up, the the sheriff did not say who they were.
Right.
Or what the...
Well, I think when they walked out the cabin and they saw that they had... They recognized that they had shot the sheriff. Literally, I shot the sheriff.
Yeah.
They realized they're in trouble.
It's time to go.
And they actually went to their neighbors, the miners that lived a few miles away, and told them what happened. This isn't like they just took off. They said, we're going away for a few days. We'll be back. And they intimated that they really didn't want to give themselves up to Graham County officials because they thought they would kill them. And they wanted to go find a friendlier jurisdiction where they could turn themselves in and be given a fair trial.
And that's the way it was supposed to be, mm-hmm. from what you said. They were supposed to wait till they came to town. The officials were to wait till they came in, and then they were to be arrested, not this.
Well, for draft evasion, that was the usual way. Rather than getting a posse to go get them, the draft evasion failure to register was just a misdemeanor. And so that was the whole procedure was a little strange, yeah.
And when you think of World War One, you never think of the draft as being the reason why, you know, we were in it. You know, the draft is more of my aunts and uncles were involved in World War II, Vietnam and everything else. But when it comes to World War One, the draft is out of mind, at least in my opinion.
It was the first large-scale draft in U.S. history, and it was new to most Americans. The Civil War, there was a draft both in the North and the South, and it was a dismal failure. So the government this time around in World War One really made some strict guidelines to make sure everyone signed up. But a lot of boys felt that they needed to be home running the farm.
Great depression's going on. Families barely eating.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't a depression in 1917 or 18, but if you're living off the land and all the guys that are young.
World War II. I'm jumping ahead. I'm getting my ones and twos combined.
If you're a family that lives off the land or proceeds of a mine or a cattle operation and all your young men are gone, it really did hurt the economy in Arizona because it was based on those three industries and all the young men were being sent to war in Europe. And they just didn't really believe in that war, and they were among the 3 million men who evaded the draft, most of whom lied about their age, hid out in the hills like the Power Boys were doing, or moved to a different town where they weren't known. Some of them did some drastic things. They shot off a toe,
pretty drastic.
Some of them got themselves addicted to drugs. Mm. And I think the most radical thing is a lot of them rushed to the altar and got married, mistakenly believing that being married would exempt you from military service.
And it was only a misdemeanor, you said.
Yes, and it did not. Yes. And so, you know, it was a little chaotic for a lot of families to have to do. I met a gentleman not too long ago. He said he had 5 uncles during World War One evade the draft, the whole family of them, so the brothers. So this was not unusual for.
So 28-day manhunt. They surrender, exhausted, tired. They go to trial. They get sentenced. What's the sentencing?
They are sentenced with premeditated murder. Now, you think about it, when Jeff Power walked out of the cabin, the first shots, according to the federal marshal, Frank Haynes, the first shots were inside the cabin. And then he said, Jeff Power went down. He'd been hit. So was he implying that the Power Boys shot their own father? I think there's a lot of evidence that the first shots came from the deputy outside and instead. So a lot of people didn't buy into that premeditated murder charge, that they were lying in wait for the lawmen to shoot them. Because quite frankly, nobody shot at the lawmen for a few minutes into the gunfight. That was contradicted all evidence on the ground.
Yeah, it would take a while to, you're in bed still by the accounts. I mean, to get up, grab a gun, this is a few minutes or a few seconds to develop. Right. You're not immediately returning fire. So how long were they sentenced for?
They were sentenced to life, and the only reason they escaped the hangman's noose was Arizona had outlawed the death penalty at that time. So they were sentenced to life, and they actually sat in prison without a parole hearing for over 35 years.
And this was at Florence?
At Florence, yes. and they were in the very well, they were well respected by the prison guards because of their really good behavior. They were put out on the work gangs. They built the state roads. They were what we call trustees because they were well behaved. They did escape a couple times. Tom Power escaped once, and he went kind of on joyriding. He got a car somehow, went to San Diego, and whooped it up. And then they caught him and brought him back, but he didn't commit any crimes while he was on this spree. He said, "I just want to go see the country and enjoy myself." These were young men in their 20s. And then in the 30s, the Depression hit the prison pretty hard, and everybody was escaping from the state prison. The local journalists had box scores. Oh, how many people escaped today? They didn't even have funding for gas for the cars to go chase after guys when they broke out. And so both Tom and John Power escaped for a few months, went to Mexico until they ran out of money, and then they were caught by the Border Patrol and brought back to prison. But they always had exemplary behavior.
So they finally get their parole hearing, and it's due to a reporter for the Arizona Republic,
who was
chasing a completely separate story.
Don Dodaro came out to the Florence prison, talked to Warden Iman, and said, was talking to another prisoner. He said, "I have a story for you. You got to interview these guys." Well, by then, they were in their 60s. Mm-hmm. Tom Sisson, who had died in prison at age 87, in 1957, had just passed away, and the wardens really thought this was a shame, that these boys should be given a hearing. Don Dodaro, who still is with us, he's 89 years old and going strong.
Lives in Payson.
He was a young man at the time. He was the number one columnist for the Arizona Republic. He would go on, of course, to be editor of the Arizona Highways magazine, but he was well known in the state, and he started to do research on this, and they had been characterized in the newspapers during their trial as these horrible anarchists and the monsters of 1918. Don Dodaro revised that story, came up with a much more sympathetic view of them, and suddenly they were kindly old gentlemen who would not hurt anyone, and there was quite an uproar. Eugene Pulliam was the editor of the Republic at the time, staunch conservative Republican, and he said nothing as the firestorm began, with all the relatives screaming that the Powers should stay in jail for all times, whereas the general public started to advocate for their release.
Well, the book is Arizona Deadliest Gunfight. Author joining us in studio, Heidi Osler, state historian, and you teach at ASU?
Yes, I do, part-time.
Wonderful. And obviously, this book is available now.
Yes, it is, on the University of Oklahoma Press website, Amazon. It's available in hardback, ebook, and audio.
And you can, of course, find those links at rosieonthehouse.com and today's archive page. Thanks for joining us and sharing this story of Arizona's deadliest gunfight.
Thank you for having me.